if decentralization is good, does it mean we should just continue decentralizing or splitting up the country into more and more administrative districts? That question is also not answered.
Hello and welcome to the Brentus Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marie-Noah Ngokolo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. If you're new here, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you're a regular, hey, how's it going? So this is the podcast where I share a lot of the super interesting conversations I have with really cool people. I'm a firm believer in sharing ideas that shape and challenge the world as we know it. My hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations wherever you are and lead to the exploring of actions and ideas that actually work and make a difference. So without further ado, let's get straight into it. Again, I'm Marie Noel and you're listening to the Brentus Foundation podcast. On the Travel Express. Today's chat will involve two of my personal favorite people. Do you ever have conversations with some people and leave feeling intellectually challenged but also super inspired? Well, that's the essence with Henry and James. Henry Telly and James Jensi both are country economists with the International Growth Center based out of Accra, Ghana. In this episode, they share insights on a paper they published along with several other IGC colleagues on the promise and pitfall of technology, evidence from tax collection in Ghana. In the description box is a link to the paper. You should have a read. But because this conversation is slightly longer than usual, don't run away. It's a really good one. I will get straight into the chat, which I found to be eye-opening and engaging with two of Ghana's best economists, if I do say so myself. Let's get straight into the chat. So James, Henry, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to have you here. Before we get started, I thought we could play a very short game just to, you know, familiarize the audience with who you are as individuals. Are you ready? It will take a very short while.
Okay.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, pleasure. So what was the first job on your respective resumes or CVs?
The first job, I think for me, it was national service.
What'd you do?
I was a teacher in the secondary school.
Interesting. James, what about you?
The same applied to me. I was my first official job was through the national service. And I serve as a teaching assistant at the university.
Ah, I see. So for anybody looking to have your career path, the goal is national service. You have to teach. Got it. How many languages do you both speak?
Let me see. Maybe about...
So many, you have to count. You have to check your CV.
Five
languages. What are those?
So I can speak obviously English,
yeah.
I can speak Ghan, I can speak Vagala,
wow.
I can speak Bala.
Wow. Okay, we're competing with heavy waiters here. James, what about you?
No, not that much. I do speak English, Ewe, Chui, and a little bit of Swedish.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's definitely different. Wow, you went out there. Okay. So one question I have for you is, what is the one skill you would say you underestimated but has served you really well with your work?
Only one.
Give us one.
I think, there are a number of them, you know, diplomatic skills. You know, being able to talk to, you know, different kinds of people and work with different kinds of people at the same time.
Okay, that's a good one. Thank you. James, what about you? Is there any skill
I will echo the people skills. We are all taught the hard competencies, yeah, skills in school, but not much emphasis on having to work with people at the same level, people beneath you and your superiors. I think within your organization, and also particularly with our work, being able to work with people, policymakers, and other stakeholders, requires a lot of soft skills. And I think Henry got it right. He is actually the master of that art, and I am his apprentice.
Henry, we are waiting for the course on that. We'll all join and take it because we all use it. Okay. All right. The last question I have for you. Indeed. What comes to mind when you hear Africa 2050? What's the first thing, I should say, that comes to mind for you?
So for me, I think when I hear of Africa 2050, I see a continent free of war, needs, and free from oppression.
Mm. Well, that's a good one. Okay. Henry, what about you?
I see cities, because it's like there's increasing urbanization.
Yeah.
And so I see a continent that would have a lot more cities and very large cities.
Interesting. Are you both optimistic? I mean, James, yours seems very, it does seem optimistic, but is it optimism mixed with pragmatism, or is it something you really just hope by some way, some stroke happens?
So I am cautiously optimistic. when I look back just 20 years ago, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, I've seen a lot of progress in Africa. And that gives me a lot of hope that if we keep that path, we will reach a stage where we make poverty a history. We're talking more in terms of consumer issues and more concerned more about the environmental sustainability issues rather than better and brighter. But I'm also cautious in the sense that things that we thought we lay behind are emerging again, particularly in the West African section. We've seen military coups returning, and that gives me a great deal of concern. I also have concern in terms of our ability to deal with the climate change issues, how we can mitigate and how we can effectively adapt to them.
Yes, I'm an optimist by nature. So I am very optimistic. But also, I mean, the evidence the last 30 years also supports that optimism. That we are on a trajectory. It may be slow, but we are definitely getting better.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Well, thank you both for indulging. That was fun for me. Now on to the main meal. And I'm really, really excited to have you both share with us your knowledge and expertise, especially with the audience at the Brentus Foundation. Can you, for those who aren't exactly aware, and I imagine it would be few to none, can you share a little bit about the work that you do at IGC, especially from the Ghana office?
Yes, I'll start with that. So the IGC, International Growth Center, brings together a global network of academic researchers and policymakers in developing countries to work together to generate knowledge or evidence that can inform and shape policies towards sustainable and inclusive growth in developing countries. So we are headquartered at the London School of Economics, but jointly run by both the LSE and University of Oxford. So we have offices across about 10 countries in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and South Asia. So James and I are based in the Ghana office, which is in Accra. And our work here as country economists involves four broad things. First, policy engagement. So we engage closely with policymakers to try to understand the issues or questions or constraints that they are facing with respect to the problem they are trying to solve.
Yeah.
And secondly, we do project development. So we bring together teams of academic researchers and policy stakeholders to work together to develop research projects that address or examine some of those issues that we see. And then this allows us to, you know, make sure that the research that is being undertaken by academic researchers is sort of anchored on real issues, clear issues that policymakers are interested in. And this increases the likelihood that they would use the findings and the recommendations.
Yeah.
And of course, the research is funded by the International Growth Center.
Mm-hmm.
And what we also do, the third thing is, for James and I, we undertake research ourselves to address some of those issues in collaboration with policymakers. And then the final thing is program management. That is managing the IGC program in Ghana with respect to, you know, looking at our country strategy, reporting to our headquarters and all of that. So that's a long answer to a short question.
No, it's an apt answer. Thank you. Thank you very much. So one of the main reasons why we're here is I came across a paper that you both co-authored along with some other colleagues that I thought was really interesting. Can you share a little bit about, you know, what inspired your recent paper on the promise and pitfall of technology? And I believe Ghana was the case study.
Thank you for the question. I think at the very high level, what inspired this research is how can we make poverty a history? That's the high level. But more concretely, how effectively taxes are raised and spent determine to a very great extent the welfare of the citizen and even the legitimacy of the government in question. Therefore, in a decentralized context, it is essential that the local governments have the capacity to mobilize tax revenues in order to deliver on their mandates. However, in the case of Ghana, as in many other countries in the sub-region, the capacity of the local governments to mobilize tax revenues are very low, to the extent that these local governments tend to depend on central governments for transfers. Now, this has two issues. One, these central government transfers are not adequate, but most critically, it defeats the very essence of decentralized government. The essence of a decentralized government is to bring governors closer to the people for them to determine it. So if you have a decentralized regime that tends to depend on the central government for transfers, this would defeat their ability to actually deliver on their mandate.
Mm.
Now, it has been heard, the view is that one way for local government to improve their task capacity is IT systems. This seems to make sense. Well, if they have databases, they have IT, they can track and all that.
Right.
The challenge, though, is that there is no rigorous study into the effectiveness of these IT systems. These IT systems require investment. What is the return sufficient to pay for itself? In addition, what are the potential pitfalls of these IT systems when deployed, and how can we minimize those potential pitfalls? Those questions are not answered yet, so we thought we should look into it and look at, one, to what extent these IT systems could be, improve the capacity of the local government in Ghana to improve revenue collection, and is the improved revenue collection sufficient to pay for the investment required to have these IT systems? And thirdly, what are the potential shortfalls in this system? So that's what we set out to do.
No, that's really helpful. And I think you've actually sort of outlined what, I guess, the next phase of the conversation would be. Can you tell us a bit about the findings from this, right? The extent to which it would actually improve, is that enough, you know, justification for the investment? And also what some of these shortfalls are that need to be considered?
Okay, so in the case of Ghana, we collaborated with one of the main, the big local governments in Ghana, and a software service provider who designed the IT system, which we call the Enhanced Revenue Mobilization System. And we did a randomized control trial to see to what extent this IT system improved revenue collection. Indeed, we saw that it was really useful in revenue mobilization from several fronts. One, the IT system makes it easy for the revenue collectors to identify the various properties for which the tax input is imposed. Then the second bit is that it helps them to distribute the, what we call the bills, to the property owners more effectively. And it helps also in collecting the revenues. Then, perhaps more importantly, it helps in detecting non-payment of property rates and deterring the property owners from not paying. So we saw, for instance, that on average, the revenue collectors that used the Enhanced Revenue Mobilization System distributes on average around 30% more bills to property owners than their counterparts that were using the old system. However, we also saw that per each bill distributed, those using the technology collected more revenue per each bill than their counterparts using the old system. So we try to investigate. Yes, we understand why those using the software or the technology would distribute more bills, but why is it that for each bill they distribute, they collect more? One of the things we found was that because they were able to distribute more, the time they have available to them, they use it to learn more about the property owners, and we're able to determine those property owners that are more likely to pay than the others. So that's broadly what we found. Now, on the pitfall, one thing that we found though is that those using the technology do not only learn about the property owners who are more willing to pay and therefore focus their efforts on them. They also learn about those property owners, but particularly those on the lower rank of the income ladder, who are willing to pay unauthorized or to make unauthorized payments and extorted unauthorized payments from them. So that is one pitfall that we found that is rather concerning.
Just to add the background as well. So, you know, Ghana administratively is currently divided into, I think, about 261 districts for administrative local governments. And in they are called Metropolitan Municipal District Assemblies, MMDAs. In 2017, when we started this project, we went to all the districts or MMDAs, and we conducted a survey, you know, trying to understand, you know, their revenue collection practices. You know, they are responsible for collecting property taxes and business operating permit, among other revenue sources. So, but they were not collecting enough. So we were trying to understand what is going on across all the districts. And we discovered several things. And one of the things we discovered was that those, even though general collection was very low, those who were using some form of IT system were doing much better. Most districts just had paper files for their, you know, properties. So somebody needs to go through the paper files and find out who has paid and who hasn't paid. And also, you know, navigating to those properties was not, it wasn't digitized. So it's difficult for somebody to actually find which property and deliver a bill. So bill deliveries were low, collections were low. So econometrically, we were able to show that technology was useful, but then the experiment Jane described helped us to, you know, show the causal impact of technology on the collection capacity.
I see. No, thank you for the added color around that. A question I had, right, was, so you sort of came up with this caveat about the need for it to be carefully designed so, you know, you minimize some of the unintended, like, outcomes. Is there, did you come across the best way to do that? And an even more important question I have is, in the conversations you've had in follow-up to this research, does it look like something that would be taking up? Usually a lot of these decisions have to be politically expedient. If not, what would it take to convince a country like Ghana to roll something up like this on a larger scale, to follow, to implement, to iterate? Because as you've, you know, found in your research, it's not just helpful by a little margin, it's super helpful.
So yes, so let me take the last part first, because that's the, perhaps the not often that researchers, we do our research and we find policymakers excited about the findings and follow our path or our recommendations. So for this particular project, we've worked with policymakers right from the conceptualization of the issues to be discussed, to be investigated, and throughout the stages of the research, we've been in constant conversation with policymakers. So the good news is that the government of Ghana has adopted this technology, and they are in the process of rolling out throughout all the over 260 local governments in Ghana. So we are excited about that. Now, on the caveat part or of carefully designed, there are two parts of this carefully designed caveat. The first part is to carefully design the technology in the sense of conceptualization. How does this technology takes into account the various stages of property rate collection, starting from identifying the properties, having a database of the properties, making it, I mean, evaluating and assessing the rate impulse, making it easy for revenue collectors to locate the properties, give them the bills, collect the taxes, and be able to assess who has paid, who has not, and have follow-ups or prompts, have a sort of prompt so that the officials could follow up to collect and enforce and improve compliance. So that's the technical part. But when we say carefully designed, there is also the bit about the implementation. How do you implement this carefully designed IT system such that you minimize the unintended consequences?
Mm-hmm.
For nearly every policy, there are unintended consequences. They tend to come not from the policy design per se, but the policy implementation. And this is one example. So for instance, I said that the technology helped the revenue collectors to learn about the property owners and be able to assess those who are willing to pay. Unfortunately, they also learn about those who are willing to pay bribes. So that is not the intention of the technology. The technology empowers the revenue collectors in a way to learn about them, but they also learn for their own selfish interest. So here, in terms of implementation, we are thinking about how do you minimize the potential of the revenue collectors to extort, for instance, bribes. And we have in mind a real-time monitoring of the revenue collectors on the field. We have in mind whenever the incident of malfeasance is detected, there's thunder coming.
Oh, wow.
It's raining, so.
No, you're fine. It's part of nature.
Yeah. So we are saying that the system in the implementation, we should have a part where there is a real-time monitoring of the revenue collectors. Monitoring about the effort they exert, monitoring about potential malfeasance, and whenever any malfeasance is detected, there is the need to investigate it thoroughly and dealt with it in a manner that it is neither attractive to the revenue collector nor the ratepayer or the taxpayer to cheat. Now, the monitoring bit is important partly because it's going to minimize this incident of bribery, but it's also going to deter. Once the revenue collectors know that they're being monitored, they'll be a bit more careful whether to engage in malfeasance or not. So when we have in mind carefully designed, we mean two things: carefully designed from the technical parts of the technology, and then carefully designed from the implementation part.
Okay, I think that's helpful. So before sort of I move away from this, I was just wondering, what surprised you both the most about this research project, and why was that?
So I think the surprise was the pitfall. When we were thinking about this project and when we saw the technology, one of the things we concluded, or in our mind we thought the technology would also automatically do, is that we thought it would automatically minimize the cases of corrupt practices. But when it was implemented, it seemed, at least from the data, that it didn't do that. And that was surprising to us, because it's something we just thought would automatically happen, because the technology in a sense was fit for purpose and carefully designed, not only into the point of identifying the property owners, valuing and, you know, giving them the bills, but it also, there was some level of monitoring that was also built in, because somebody can sit at the back end and determine whether the revenue collector has actually visited the property.
Yeah.
So we thought all of these built in would greatly minimize, you know, the cases of practice, but that didn't happen. So that was a huge surprise. And so we had to do a lot more work to try to understand what was really going on.
Cool. Awesome. So now, I guess, sort of scaling up the chat a little bit, because James, you sort of hinted at this at the beginning anyway. This work, right, can be situated broadly in the larger conversation around decentralization in Ghana. And I know it's a very big topic and one that we can write an extensive amount on, but for the purposes of this conversation, I'm hoping you would engage me in terms of, would you say that so far, or at least from the evidence we have, that decentralization has been good for Ghana? Or maybe have we not done it well enough to know whether it is or will be? And also from your work, is there evidence of, you know, where and when it has worked really well, and other areas that maybe it hasn't?
Okay, maybe I'll take the first part, then Harry will continue. So we started decentralization when we were actually under a military regime. So this decentralization was the first step towards democracy for us. And to that extent, we celebrate decentralization because it is what opened the way for us to have the full-fledged democracy that we have today. The question itself, whether decentralization has led to development, is a bit difficult. Whichever way I answer it, there will be pushback, and I want my response to be in that regard, in that light. Since we have decentralization, Ghana has made tremendous strides. Is that because of decentralization, or is that in spite of decentralization?
Mm.
It's not very clear. But what we do know for sure is when we had the decentralization and new districts or local governments were created, these districts needed to have certain facilities like the administrative office and the other districts' offices, like the Ministry of Health needs to have administrative offices, Ministry of Environment needs to have. They need to have district hospitals. So creating the districts for an otherwise underdeveloped location means the provision or speeds up the provision of these facilities. So from those underdeprived districts' point of view, decentralization speeds up the provision of basic needs that they required. So to that extent, yes. Now, I want to raise a caveat here. Exactly because if an underdeveloped area is demarcated as a district, these facilities come in. A lot of the local people are now in demand. We want to have our own districts because they do know if they have, they'll have at least a district hospital. The problem with that is leading to a proliferation of districts that are, to some of them, to my mind, are not viable districts. A district or a local government should be able to have ability to generate sufficient revenue on its own. If you just carve an completely underdeveloped area, perhaps even the size being too small, They may not be able to function as an economic unit. And they may end up, as the case in Ghana, over depending on the central government for some financial support. And that, to me, will undermine the very essence of decentralization. So my central point is, yes, decentralization is good. It has the potential to deepen democracy. It has potential to speed up development. But there needs to be a fine balance between the proliferation of districts and the economic viability of these districts.
I see. Awesome. Thank you for that. Henry, did you want to weigh in here as well?
Yes. So, I mean, both James and I are still students of decentralization. There are, you know, like you rightly pointed out, still a lot of unanswered questions from the empirical side. So empirically, it's a difficult question to answer whether decentralization has been good. If we are trying to, you know, show the exact impact of decentralization. But I think theoretically, I would say decentralization has been is good. Theoretically, it is good. So doing this work, you know, forced us to learn a lot more about decentralization. And one of the things I learned a lot about was the Decentralization Act, the 2016 Act. And I read that, you know, that's probably one of the laws I've read from cover to cover. And I think it's a good law. It's a good law. It is still not fully implemented, or the implementation is still not at the point where it mimics exactly what is written. So there are challenges there, but you can also see that over the years there have been more and more consistent or incremental progress towards implementing the law. And so I think we haven't implemented it long enough to be able to empirically show the impact. But I think the law we have currently is good. It provides all the things that you would expect. Now, and the dilemma James presents is also there. You know, if decentralization is good, does it mean we should just continue decentralizing or splitting up the country into more and more administrative districts? That question is also not answered yet, empirically. So, I mean, these are areas that I think, you know, we would encourage researchers to take up, because it genuinely, the Ministry of Local Government, the Office of the Head of Local Government Service, these are questions that they are interested in. You know, would be interested in finding out what the answer is to help them with future policies.
Awesome. And before I go on, I think one question I had was, you know, this, you mentioned that you're both students of decentralization, and I'll argue as am I and probably many others. What would you say from the work you've done so far, maybe from what you're seeing, would be, you know, the next best or next set of great steps that would help to deepen decentralization efforts in Ghana? If you could put it down to one or two things, what comes to mind about, you know, things that we could be doing or should be doing or should have done yesterday?
Well, I think there are several things, but the first thing I would say is there must be a a strong link between local financing and the provision of services in the local communities. And the communities must see the size of the revenue that has been raised, how it has been used, and they should be in position to ascertain whether this is value for money and question their leaders. And this will deepen accountability, transparency, and that DSA will also improve the willingness of the citizens to pay more taxes for the development of their own community. I think that link needs to be strengthened. So I will keep it there.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, I agree with James. The other thing I would add is there is still this question about the kind of leadership that the local government should have. Should it be elected or appointed in the current the way it's done currently? And the empirically again, it's not a clear cut issue. But I think when the discussions are being had, normally we just look at all of them as similar. Like I said, there are metropolitan, municipal, and district assembly. So we in thinking about this question of whether the leaders or the leadership should be elected or appointed, we shouldn't try to do one type for all. It could be that we can look at metropolitan assemblies and say, well, they should have elections to elect the chief executives or the mayors.
Yeah.
And that would make sense because these are bigger areas. They can raise a lot more money and can fund a lot more of that election. Some of the districts, like Jane said, may not be so viable. They are small. And so even if you hold elections there, you are, you know, really just going to spend money that you are not likely to be able to raise in those districts. So the impacts in terms of development may not be that great, even if you elect the leader. So there are still a lot of questions in that area that I think researchers and even us, we are looking at more work in that area.
Yeah, no, awesome. Thank you for that. So finally, before I let you both go, and thank you for the time that you've given me. I'm really, really thankful. There's a crop of right people coming up, obviously, as any other time, especially in, if we look at policy analysis. What advice do you have for them in tackling some of the seemingly hard questions about growth and development, especially in a slightly polarized political space such as Ghana? What are the kinds of questions that they should be asking? How do they find out the right kinds of questions that would be beneficial? For instance, if they are not, in an organization that maybe has the ear of, let's say, policymakers, or how should they try to go about this? I'm trying to think of the ways that, upcoming students, upcoming policy analysts, researchers, and the likes can have the most impact.
Okay, so first, try to stay as apolitical as possible. That's the
point. Yeah.
but more seriously, I will advise that we engage policymakers more. Let us get to understand the issues that keep them awake, and figure out how we could turn those issues into academically interesting questions. So for most researchers, we are interested in academically interesting research. That is what we do. That's how we are paid for to do. Yeah. But do we want to do research that is academically interesting, but has no immediate policy relevance.
Yeah.
I'm not saying all researches should have immediate policy relevance, but we need to increase the volume of academically relevant, useful research that is still relevant for policy. And the way we can do that is to have conversation with them. What are the issues that they are grappling with? And I remember when I came back to Ghana, I was talking to a colleague about going to a Ministry of Finance to talk to policymakers. The response I had was, they are not going to mind you. They don't have, it was dismissing that no policymakers are not interested in talking to researchers. But it turns out that when you get to them to understand the issues they have, they are really cooperative. Yes, of course, every industry, there are challenges, but you'd be surprised to know that with time, you build a very good relationship with them and be able to do research work that is academically exciting, but also influence policy directly for you to see. And it's even more rewarding, I would agree.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that. Before you wrap up, Henry, do you want to add on here?
Yes, just, I mean, along the line that James started, you know, having conversation, but going beyond that to build very good relationships with policymakers. And when you build those relationships, you will actually be surprised some of the things you are able to do, because there's so much information and so much to do, so many questions that have not been answered. And sometimes they have administrative data or data that, you know, it's not digitized. It may be on paper, so you can work with them to digitize it and use it to answer questions that would surprise you.
Amazing. Henry, James, thank you. Thank you so much. This has been an enjoyable conversation for me, and I'm very certain insightful for many others as well. I know you're super busy. So again, really thank you for the time, for the openness to have this conversation, and also for being willing to share your experience with me.
Thank you for having us.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrenthurstfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brenthurst Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.